Welcome to the Nature Reliance Podcast, where we explore the history and practical experience of the great outdoors and discover new ways to connect with nature. I'm Craig Cottle, your guide through the fascinating world of natural living and survival skills through experiential education and interviews. Today's episode is brought to you by the Nature Reliance School Online Membership, an immersive online learning experience designed for outdoor enthusiasts just like you. Are you passionate about the outdoors? Do you crave more knowledge about disaster readiness, wilderness survival, bushcraft, tracking, and nature awareness? If so, the Nature Reliance School Online Membership is your gateway to a community of like-minded individuals, all dedicated to learning and sharing essential outdoor skills. With the Nature Reliance School Online Membership, you get exclusive access to a wealth of resources, including expert-led tutorials, interactive webinars, and a library of engaging courses, downloadable books, and documents. Whether you're a beginner or an experienced outdoorsman, there's always something new to learn. So don't wait. Click on the link below to join the Nature Reliance School Online Membership today. Embrace the wilderness, enhance your skills, and become part of a community that values nature as much as you do. Now, let's dive into today's episode. Hey there, everybody. This is Craig Cottle, Director of Nature Reliance School. Welcome to another episode of the Nature Reliance Media Podcast. Check out naturereliance.org for all things related to Nature Reliance School. On our website, you're going to find all of our other podcasts, our blog, our courses, and our store. And when I say our courses, this is what I mean. We've got online courses, we've got one-day courses, we've got hands-on weekend-long courses, and our latest installment and one of the most fun things we've had doing is our live stream Zoom coursework. So check it out, naturereliance.org.
Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Tracy Trimble, and I will be your primary host for this episode. Now, I'm a firm believer that if you do something with risk and haven't had an accident, then you just haven't been doing it long enough, because accidents will happen. It's like an undefeated boxer. An undefeated boxer is just a boxer that hasn't fought long enough. Defeat is bound to happen, and an accident is bound to occur. Such an accident hit our search and rescue team back in 2019. If you have listened to the podcast before, you know that I'm a volunteer member on a search and rescue team that serves Central Kentucky and primarily the Red River Gorge area. This team is an all-volunteer team, but it is one of the most professional organizations I've been associated with, and that is a direct reflection of our leadership. John May, our chief, Mike Hackett, our assistant chief, and Mark Ryan, our training officer. Today, John and Mike join Craig and I as we discuss that 2019 accident. The following discussion details a fall that John underwent when he and another teammate, Becky, were rappelling to gain a faster access to a lost hiker. John and Mike detail the small errors that culminated that night. They discuss the errors, the uncontrolled descent or fall, Mike's medical assistance to John, raising John back to the cliffside top, and John's injuries and recovery. Before we get into the Zoom recording of the discussion, note that the team provided us with photos of that night and have given us permission to use them in a blog. That blog is located at naturereliance.org. If you have any questions, please let us know by sending us an email to info@naturereliance.org. All right, let's begin. Thanks, guys, for coming in. Welcome to the podcast. Thank you all for joining in and listening to us. We got some individuals here. We got John May with us, who is our search and rescue chief. We have Mike Hackett, who is assistant SAR chief and our go-to guy for medical help. And we have the one and only Craig Cottle that has jumped on the Zoom meeting with us. That's the way we're recording this podcast. And then myself, Tracy Trimble. I figure we just go around the loop here and introduce everybody and tell us a little bit about yourself and your background, search and rescue, or anything else that you want to let the listeners know. John, we'll start with you.
Yep. First of all, Tracy and Craig, we appreciate you guys for giving us a shout to come over and join in on the podcast tonight. And hopefully your listeners will find what we have to say interesting. But I've been on the Wolf County Search and Rescue Team. That's going on 18 years. Seen and done a lot of things in that time period. I think somewhere around 700 or 800 rescues I've been involved with, from, you know, the very easy to the very complicated rescues over the years. I'm a wilderness first responder for the team, and I also teach technical rope rescue and swift water rescue for the state of Kentucky. So I've been doing rope rescue for quite a while, and I'm sure we'll get into some of those activities here shortly. So,
absolutely. John, just real quick, how did you get involved in search and rescue?
Yeah, initially, you know, I wanted to find a way to get back to the community. I'd reached out to the local fire department, actually. I thought about being a fireman, and at that time, Don Figg was getting ready to retire, who is a legendary U.S. Forest Service law enforcement agent. He said they were trying to start up a rescue team in the county. I've always been pretty much an outdoorsman, and that was, you know, when I heard that, the lights went off, and I'm like, yeah, you know, I want to get in on that. So we really didn't have anything back in those days. We didn't have a rope. We didn't have a truck. We didn't have any training, and we just had some people, you know, wanting to make a difference. You know, we started recruiting and fundraising and kind of building the team from there. You know, now I would say, of course, I guess I'm a little impartial, but I think we got one of the best teams in the state, and, you know, a lot of great-hearted people and like-minded people that just want to go out and make a difference when people find themselves in harm's way.
Yeah, I agree with you. We definitely, Wolf County Search and Rescue definitely has to be one of the busiest search and rescue teams in the state. And if you start looking down at some of the talent and the skills that we have on the team, it's pretty significant, I think. You mentioned Don Figg, John. He had written a book about his years and years of search and rescue, and I haven't been able to get a copy of that book. I know it was discussed maybe about a year ago, something that they might be generating more copies, printing more copies. Do you know anything about that? Yep. What's the status of that?
I have heard that they are, you know, looking into doing a new publication of that book, but I happen to have one of those. So if you want to read it, I'd be happy to lend it out to you. But Don himself was very much an inspiration to me. You know, several things in that book have really stuck in my heart, you know, listening to, you know, what he encountered and what he had to do, you know, as a rescuer back in the day. You know, that plays in every rescue I go out on. I think back on a lot of the things that he encountered and, you know, some of the regrets that he had. It really plays a role in how I conduct myself out there even today.
Well, we appreciate it. Mike, we will jump over to you. Mike Hackett, Assistant SAR Chief for the Wolf County Search and Rescue Team and our go-to medic guy. How you doing? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm good, Tracy. Thanks for having us on, both of you guys. And again, we appreciate you guys coming out and giving us some of your knowledge of what you guys have encountered over the years. So for me, I've been on the search and rescue team, I think it's going on 6 years. My background is medical, like you're saying. I'm a nurse, and I'm a specially trained nurse for anesthesia, so I'm a nurse anesthetist. I've been out in the woods pretty much my whole life. I did a little hunting when I was a kid and went into climbing as I was going through college and grad school. And from there, I met Mark Ryan, who is our training officer on the team. And we hung out and have done some trips of our own and some epic battles out in the woods. And listening to his stories with John on what they have gone through, what they've done, kind of got me interested in joining the team.
That's they pulled you right in, didn't they?
I don't know what they did, but yeah, it's kind of fun. We have a good time. We're a big family is kind of how we just encounter the world, how we talk to each other.
Yeah. Hey, Mike, what was your first rescue, by the way?
My first rescue was a cow rescue. We were chatting about that last night. We kind of mentioned it earlier that we were just texting back and forth. And John said his first rescue, and it was a super awesome chimney top rescue. And he knew what he was in for as soon as that happened. And I chimed in and I just said, you know, well, mine was a cow rescue. So,
yeah. Oh, man, that's good.
Well, the question is, did you get the cow?
We got the cow. That was a really cold night. And I think it was January of 14 or 15. One of our other teammates, Cal, went over the cliff, so we planned the rescue exercise, but he couldn't contain it because it was just running around, and he could not get it up himself. So we had to get a vet to give us a prescription dart. We had to go get the gun. We had to shoot the cow, and then, well, with a tranquilizer, not with a projectile. And after the cow was sedated in 10 degree weather, we had to just throw blankets on it and the dog harness on this cow, which looked like a just a tiny little thing on it. Yeah. And I was out in my crampons on the boots because it was icy going up and down the cliff. And then, you know, we had reporters out there and 2 feet of cow dung and everything else. But it was really was kind of epic. And I kind of knew what I was getting into there too.
Mike said, I signed up for this.
Yeah. And little do we know, just this year we ended our major rope season with another cow patty rescue as well. Maybe another story.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Hey guys and gals, a quick break in our episode to talk about a game changer in outdoor cooking, the Fire Maple backpacking and camping stove system. Whether you're hiking, fishing, or even prepping for emergencies, this portable pot and jet burner is a must-have in your gear. Best part? It's nearly half the price of a comparable JetBoil stove system. Thanks to its leading heat exchange technology, you'll experience reduced boiling times by up to 30% compared to traditional stoves, even in windy conditions. That means more time enjoying the outdoors and less time cooking. Are you ready to upgrade your outdoor cooking game? Click the link in the description now to grab yours. Trust me, your outdoor adventures will never be the same.
All right, Mike, we appreciate that. And I know whenever we're out and about, it's always good to see you coming down the road and joining in with your medical expertise and stuff. I always feel much more comfortable when you're around. And I'm sure that lost individuals out there notice it as well. Moving on up the screen, we have the one, the only, the man, Craig Cottle. Craig, how you doing, buddy?
I'm good, man.
Tell us a little bit what's going on in your world in Nature Reliance School.
I tell you what, man, I'm just excited to be in the background on one of these for a change. I like being a nobody every now and then. Just I'm really excited to hear what happened to John and Mike's take on it after he got down to him. And I'm looking forward to that. Got a few questions I'm sure that'll pop up. So thank you guys for letting me be in the background on this one. I love being in this position on a regular basis too.
Well, good. We're glad that you jumped in. So as we covered in the introduction, this is going to be an incident where our search and rescue chief, John, he had an accident on cliffside and fell. And we're going to get into the details of that. We'll go ahead and jump into everything. This happened on July 4th of 2019, 4:30 p.m. Our team gets a call, pretty routine call, about three individuals who are lost on Swift Camp Creek. And we had a really good turnout that day. I think there was 8 or 9 of us that went in to assist these three individuals. We actually had 3 new people that went in with us that day, first time out. We had made contact with the three individuals, and we were working our way back to the parking lot, almost to the parking lot, and we get a second call. That second call was a lady that was lost in the Chimney Rock area, the Red River Gorge, if you're familiar about that. That's one of the hot spots in that area. John, you were at IC running everything from IC Incident Command.
Yep.
So let me turn it over to you and kind of tell us what happened from there on.
Yeah, well, a couple of things there. Becky Brewer, who's a team member, a longstanding team member, had showed up as well. So it was Becky and I were at IC coordinating the rescue that was going on that you were part of. And then we received that second call from our dispatch. And the initial call was, like a lot of calls, it was a little vague. It was reported that someone was screaming for help at the base of Chimney Top, which, you know, we all know what Chimney Top means. And typically if someone's screaming at Chimney Top, it's a really bad day for someone. The area within the Red River Gorge that has the highest incidence of fatalities, it's about a 200-foot cliff. We're not aware. We've heard reports of maybe one person that has fallen from Chimney Top that has survived, but, 25-plus fatalities. So anytime we hear Chimney Top, you know, the urgency level kind of ratchets up quite a bit. So, sure. I was a little nervous when I heard that call come through, but we didn't really know what was going on. So Becky and I, made communication with the SAR team that was still in the woods, advised them of the situation and said we were going to, move our location to Chimney Top and investigate this incident further to try to find out some more information on it.
Yeah. So you and Becky head out to Chimney Top And the team that was in the field helping the three individuals that were lost, we were almost back to the parking lot. So it wasn't like we were without communications. We were almost out. We had to wrap up that before we could head out, and you all went over to assess everything. Once you all get on scene there at Chimney Top, what did you find out there?
Yeah, there was actually, we met the gentleman that had initially made the call driving out. I actually knew him, and he flagged me down and said that he had heard someone screaming for help at the base of Chimney. Really didn't provide us a lot more, a lot of information other than that at that time. So we drove on out to the trailhead. And for those that may not really know Chimney Top, it, like you said early on, Tracy, it's kind of an iconic location in the gorge, probably one of the most visited areas in the gorge. It has fairly easy access. It's a, maybe a half a mile or a quarter mile paved trail to get out to this viewing area, which you have great vistas. But it's always crowded. So when we pulled into the parking lot, there was a lot of people there. And immediately, because we were in the search and rescue vehicle, we had a family that came up to us and said that their mother had been yelling for help below the cliff line. So your SAR mind kind of starts going in to play at that point. I'm like, well, if she's screaming for help, she didn't fall off the cliff, more likely than not, because people, if you fall 200 feet, you're not in a situation to yell for help typically, or at least I've never seen it. So that made me feel a little bit better. But as we started getting more information, it was kind of determined that she was lost. She was actually lost in between Chimney Top Rock and another well-known location, which is called Half Moon, which is just a cliff line across the valley floor from that location. So, and we were actually able to get somewhat of a location for her by using her cell phone, which we do quite often. We try to make contact with lost individuals and get a coordinate so we can have some idea where they are. So at that point, things, we felt a little better about it, but it was starting to get kind of late in the day. So that was starting to play into things we were doing and how we were planning and those kind of things. So, and we decided to wait, there until the rest of the team got to our location and we would develop a plan at that point.
So once the team arrives on scene, Mark Ryan, who is a prominent figure on the search and rescue team, and you, and I'm sure Mike and Becky all kind of get together, develop a plan. What was that plan of action?
Chimney Top is an area because of, the high number of incidents and serious incidents that we have there. We train there quite often, at least a couple of times a year. We go out and do ropes training, so we practice different techniques. One of the issues we have with the rescue on Chimney Top, it's very gear intensive. So if someone falls into the crack out of the viewing area, so I don't know how I can describe that very well, but you have a rock that's kind of separated away, so you end up with a chimney in between those two pieces. And people tend to jump over the safety barriers there and fall into that crack. And sometimes they stay in the crack and sometimes they fall out the side. But either way, based just on the anchors that we have on top of chimney, it's a fairly complicated setup and requires a lot of gear, pretty much all of our gear, to be honest, to do a raise lower operation out on that point. So we had been practicing for the past couple of years a little quicker way to get someone to the bottom in the event that someone had fallen and they were alive at that point that would not tie up the remainder of our gear. Kind of an advanced technique. It's not how we normally put people to the bottom of the cliff. But if you're trained in doing it and have some experience with it, we've used it many times. We trained at that very location doing what I ended up doing that night. Based on it was getting dark, it was getting late. It was July 4th. We had just completed one rescue. We determined, hey, we've trained out here many times. Instead of driving back out, and hiking back in several miles, we felt like the right thing to do is just go and do what we'd already trained there before and, wrap down the side and go and get this lady and shorten the rescue up by 3 to 4 hours, get people out. Because there's a risk about hiking into a wilderness area after dark. And, so that played in our decision-making process. We always try to keep the risk as minimal as possible. But, anytime you're doing some of the things we do, there's certainly risk involved.
You mentioned not our typical setup. Could you take just a second? Let's assume that we have an ideal setup. What would that entail?
Yeah, we typically, and anytime you talk search and rescue, you're really talking redundancy in a lot of what we do. So if we rarely repel an actual rescue, it's much safer to lower someone down. So what we would typically have set up is a two-line system with a main and a belay, and the rescuer would simply be lowered to the base of the cliff. So that way, both their hands are free. A lot of the trails or a lot of the cliff lines we go over are grown up in brush. So you're having to kind of fight your way through some of that as you go down. And it's just easier not having to use a repelling device to make that happen. And then you have a person operating the main system, which is the primary lowering system. And then you have someone that backs that up on the belay system. And we typically either do that with using double Prusik or another MPD. I don't want to get too deep in the weeds on how we rig that, but sure. It's all redundant. So two attachment points to the rescuer, two separate systems. So if you have one fail, you've got a backup for it. Absolutely. And then, if we get them to the bottom and we need to bring them back up, it's really quick to switch that system over to a ray system, typically a 3-to-1, mechanical advantage system to get them back to the top of the cliff.
So how is that different than what you set up, or not necessarily you, but how the team set up to lower you or not lower you to repel you and Becky over the cliff?
So at the kind of the entrance, we're not really the entrance, but maybe, a quarter of the way down this trail. There's a kind of a clearing on the side of the cliff that we have trained at before to get a medic or a rescuer down to the bottom quickly so they can be, assessing the person that was, had fallen, whether they were dead or alive at that point, while the rest of the team was going out to the point to set up, the system that we just talked about. So on this particular cliff line, what we were doing this night was a single rope rappel. And we specifically did that so we wouldn't have to tie up the other gear and we could be rigging that out on the point and just get a medic down to find out how this person is doing. So it was rigged, on a what we would call a bomber anchor, very large tree, came over to a smaller tree that was on the cliff ledge that we would call a high directional. And then the rescuer, this time it was me. I was in a Class 3 harness using a, now I'll say rappelling device, but really it's more designed for a belaying device for rock climbing. And Mike may chime in on that. He's more of a rock climber than I am. But this particular device, under rock climbing conditions, it's probably more often than not used on a double rope. In my case, I was only using a single rope, not a double. And I've rappelled on that exact setup probably hundreds of times, in training and different times throughout my career. So I was very familiar with it. Wasn't anything I hadn't done before, but like with a lot of incidents, it's not always a single thing that results in the incident or the accident. It can be a lot of little things that add up to a big event. And ultimately that's what happened with my incident. And you can go all the way back to the initial decision-making process, and that's all on me. I made the decision to rappel down to get to this lady quicker versus putting people in the woods after dark. And then, we could have rigged a dual line system, which would have taken a lot more personnel and a lot more time. And once again, we had somebody in the woods that we didn't know exactly what her situation was. And then, I chose a particular device that I'd used many times, but there's other devices that I could have used that would have given me some more options when things started to go bad. So a lot of little things. And then, I was carrying, some extra weight with me. I was taking water to this individual. So my pack was loaded with about 6 bottles of water. And then, I had my normal rescue harness and all the gear that goes along with that on my person as well. And I'm not a light person. I typically, weigh 250, 255. So I'm a bigger rescuer. Mike's a more of a rock climber build. He's a little smaller than I am. So, when I get on a system, people usually know it. So, and that certainly factored into the events of this night as well.
Mike,
hey, real quick, yeah. Tracy, what's the name of that device, John, that you used?
Yeah, it's called Madlock from Mad Rock. It's a little tough to say, but I think we've got some pictures you guys may be able to show on your blog page so that people can see what we're talking about.
Okay, good.
It's designed where you can run two ropes through it. So like if you're cleaning the top anchor, if you're a rock climber and you have to rappel down, you have both lines going through it. So as you rappel down, when you get on the bottom, then you can pull the line through. It allows you to recover your equipment. But what it doesn't have is a quick way to add friction into it. There's ways you can do it using your body and some other techniques, but, as opposed to like a rack or a scarab where you have bars or horns that you can bring the rope over, this really doesn't have that option. So if you find yourself in a bad situation, you need to be on top of it because it can get away from you quick.
So for our listeners out there, John mentioned it. John was gracious enough to send us some pictures over. of the device and some other gear. And we're going to put that in a blog for those that's interested in taking a look at it. And a picture of your hands, fingers. We're going to put, he was gracious enough to put that out there. Mike, go back to the device if you can. And if you could explain that device to us just a little bit. This is a device that you have used quite often, right?
Sure. This particular device, no. There are many devices for climbing, recreational climbing, that we do use on our search and rescue in certain situations, not for rescue loads, but for personal loads. So I'll step back just a moment. You were talking about typical versus not typical rescue setups. If we can expand on typical or atypical rescue setups, what John was talking about for the rappel is exactly typical for recreational climbing. So it's not out of the ordinary. It's not something that we made up. It is well known in rescues, well known in rec, and well known rec multi-pitch, which is going up multiple different levels of climbs, and then single pitch, like cleaning the gear off of one of your anchors and then rappelling to the bottom. And the setup that John has is a light setup. It's meant to haul up a cliff for many thousands of feet without adding a lot of extra weight. So the inability to add friction to it is one of the downsides. The upside is that this is a really light device to take with you, so you're not carrying a pound, or in some of our gear, almost a pound and a half of a lowering device. So this particular device is similar to the BD. It's similar to some of the Petzl devices, but you can have the ability to put thread through one side of it. It's almost ovular in the openings, and the rope will go through one side of it, then through your locked carabiner and back out that same oval. And the friction comes from the rope going over the carabiner and then bent over the device in a 180-degree fashion. And where that carabiner is not a high level of friction. It's only minimal because most carabiners are anodized aluminum and they're super smooth. The main friction comes from that bend and how much down pressure you can place on that bend with your hand. And that is how we slow or reduce our speed, if you will, from a rappel. With enough friction, you can stop yourself very easily. However, in rec climbing now, there's always, we'll go back to the belay that John was talking about for the typical rescue setup. There is an auto block hitch that we put on to the bottom side of the rope where you're holding it for the friction to prevent a catastrophic failure. And I say prevent with quotation marks in the air because it can have some user error to it. So if you have this set up correctly, if you were to let go of it, most of the time it's going to grab the rope with its own friction and prevent any more rope from going into the device, which then stops you from lowering. Let's add on my weight. I'm 165 pounds. I can hold myself up with pretty much any device out there. John's device did not have a high level of friction on that bend. It was almost smooth because he switched it 180 degrees from the higher friction area to the lower friction area. That prevented him from controlling it as easily, still controllable, but as easily. And then let's add on that we were on a dynamic climbing rope, 10 millimeter. Once you add weight to that, and again, different weights, John's 260 pounds, 250, and I'm, you know, two thirds of his weight. So that rope stretches, and as it stretches, it actually reduces the diameter of it, which then reduces the friction into the system even more. So we keep going into those. It's a series of multiple problems that small, but multiple problems that usually add up to whatever the big incident was. Does that explain it a little bit better?
Yeah, very much. And again, we'll have some pictures out there. You mentioned dynamic rope, basically two types of rope that is being used, dynamic, and what's the other one?
So in our rescue systems, we have semi-static. It's still dynamic, meaning it can stretch as weight is applied to it. But the rescue systems, the semi-static, have a much lower stretch percentage at useful load, so around 5%. There's some variation in there. But let's say 100 feet of rope is out and you put a rescue load on it, it'll stretch 5 feet. A dynamic climbing rope is meant to absorb energy as the climber falls to not put a huge load on their climbing harness or on the body as it falls. So its dynamics is about 30% at its factor. And there's some variation in there too. We're just going to say 30 for ease of calculation. So that means 100 feet of rope out, it could stretch 30 feet. That stretch in it allows the fibers to change and to elongate. And as they elongate, the energy absorbed reduces the load on your climbing harness and on the person.
We opt not to use, you know, dynamic ropes in the rescue world because of that stretch. And you might think about that as being good, you know, if something went wrong, you know, it's kind of a shock absorber. But if you're above a cliff ledge or an outcropping and, you know, you have a little bit of a give, you know, which we try to avoid. But if you do have that, you know, and you get that extra extension, you know, we've heard reports of rescuers actually hitting those ledges and breaking their legs because of that amount of stretch that the rope would give. So, you know.
And again, on this particular setup, John, you were on a dynamic rope.
I was on a dynamic rope. Mm-hmm. Yep. Dynamic rope, 10 millimeter, which the device, the Madrock Madlock device was rated, I think at 9.3 millimeter. That's the smallest diameter.
Minimum. You can go higher. Yes.
Yeah. You can go higher, but that was the minimum. You can add an extra, it had a little spot where you could add an extra bar into it if you went smaller, but you know, we didn't have to do that based on the rope that I was using. But I'll also add too to what Mike was saying, you know, on a 200 foot cliff, you essentially have 200 feet of rope hanging below your feet when you start over. And the rope within itself also adds a little bit of friction into the system because that rope is actually, it's kind of like you pulling on it. And instead of you pulling on it, it's the weight of the rope pulling on it. So as you tend to go down the cliff, some of that friction starts to go away because you have less rope hanging between, you know, hanging down to the ground. So once again, just another little small thing that adds into this. So, but I think that kind of covers the setup we were having. Mike did mention the auto block, which I had on. We can talk a little bit more about that, you know, what happened there with that or what we believe happened. But it partially, you know, did what it should have done. But I think from what I remember about the, and maybe I should back up to kind of, you know, when I actually started this rappel, you know, kind of things that started to happen, because I don't remember too much after that, but, you know.
Well, it was two of y'all that were going to go over, you and
it Vic. Was, yeah. And, yeah.
I'm assuming I wasn't in the decision-making on that part at all, but I'm assuming it was you and Becky because everybody else had been out on the other rescue and we had walked and walked back and y'all were giving us a break, if you will, in terms of physical fitness there. So you and Becky had geared up, you got your system set up, you're on the cliff edge, and take us from there.
Yeah. So I don't know if I'm lucky or unlucky that I went first, but my guess is it wouldn't have really changed my situation. Even if Becky had gone first, what probably would have happened, I would have fallen on her and possibly killed her, you know, and during this incident. So I'm glad I went first. But as we were on the edge, as Mike mentioned earlier, one of the things that occurred, and it was dark by this point, as you'll see in some of the pictures. So you have gear on, it's dark. The only thing you can really see is what your headlamp is showing you at that point. One of those little small things that happened when I would normally use that Madrock Madlock device, I had it turned in a way that I was getting that little bit of extra friction, which how much that gives you, I don't know, but, you know, apparently it was enough to make a difference, but I had it turned the other way. So instead of my rope going over the little, it's kind of a convex, you know, it comes down to a point with some more ribs in it. Instead of going through that, it was just coming over a bar. And that certainly, you know, reduced the amount of friction that I was going to have available to use. But when I started over, the only real things that I can remember about from the time I started over until really I saw my family before I got on the ambulance was almost like little, it's kind of like a little highlight reel, kind of bits and pieces here and there. But I remember early on that I was having trouble controlling the speed. And I, you know, I know things that I can do to counter that. You know, you can take the rope and wrap it around your legs. You can bring the rope underneath your butt, you know, to try to add more friction in. But as I've talked about this to many people, it happens quick. I don't know how fast that happened, but I'm guessing, you know, split second, you know, it was because I remember early my hands were getting hot. You know, the rope was always sliding. I couldn't stop, which is, you know, not normal. You know, any other time I've used that, I've been able to just lock myself off. And then, you know, things got out of control. And really the last thing I remember was looking down and seeing trees and just hope, you know, thinking that I hope I go through the trees. I believe I did from what Mike kind of told me later on. He thinks I went through some trees, but I'm not really sure about that. So,
John, whenever you're sitting at the cliff edge as you started over, see, Mark was there, Mike was there, I was there, someone else was up there. Can't remember. There's three or four of us up on top.
Becky was there.
Yeah, Becky was there. There was nothing out of the ordinary from the initial start, was it? You breaking the cliff and heading over. Answer this one. I'm sure our listeners would like to know, how high was the cliff?
The cliff is about 200 feet.
And you estimate that you fell?
We believe somewhere around 150 feet. We kind of, you know, it's hard to say for certain, but we went back and looked at the cliff after the fact. And we believe when, you know, I more or less wasn't able to control the speed anymore is when I got into free air. And that was about 50 feet, you know, down from the top of the cliff. So somewhere around 150 feet.
So as you break the cliff and you're heading down, your speed just kind of gradually keeps starts going, right? Starts increasing, increasing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're doing what you can to slow it and can.
Mm-hmm.
And then you eventually get to a point where you're free falling, true free falling.
I mean, it's certainly from what I remember,
it's a free fall.
I mean, it's still going through your device, and I did have the auto block on, you know, on my system. And we believe what happened, you know, looking at burn patterns on the auto block, burn patterns on my fingers, it's really hard to not grab onto something if you're falling.
Sure.
So what we think happened to me once it got out of control, instead of letting go of that auto block, like Mike talked about earlier, and letting it come up and do its thing, it looks like I clamped down. You know, I think when I started to fall, I just grabbed a hold of everything and was holding on with all that I could. It burned my left hand really bad, and it burned three of the fingers on my right hand. And that's kind of indicative of having partial coverage over that auto block. So we think I probably just grabbed a hold of that, and it burned partially through the auto block. It's a 6mm cordage that we used. It burned partially through that where I was clamping down, and also where the rope made contact, where the rope was going so fast, it burned kind of where the auto block is sewn together, or the accessory cord sewn together. It started to burn through that too, just where the rope was rubbing it, you know, due to my speed at that point. So, yeah.
Quick question. The first moment that you knew it wasn't going the way you wanted it to, and I don't know if this seems like a weird question or not, did you see something, hear something, or feel something? I know you mentioned you felt the rope going through your hands really quick, and what was your first sense, literally sense, your vision, your hearing, what let you know that it wasn't right?
That I couldn't stop, that I was trying to stop and I couldn't.
Okay.
You know, no matter what I did, I couldn't get my speed to stop. And that's, you know, all this happened from the top to 50 feet down. I mean, you know, you're probably talking 7, 8, 10 seconds, you know, for me just rappelling down until I got to that point to where I was trying to stop and couldn't. And then it was, you know, unfortunately, you know, I may have tried to counter that some way, but, you know, I don't know. I know things I could have done, but did I do it? I don't know. The result would say that I didn't, because if I could have got some leg wraps on there, you know, I think that would have, you know, probably stopped me, or, you know, wrapped it over a foot and pinched it between my feet. You know, there's a lot of things you can do, but, you know, once things start to go bad, I mean, your mind, it happens so quick. I've talked to Mark, and Mike and I have talked a lot about this, and, you know, most people that do a lot of rappelling, especially rock climbing, the ones, you know, a lot of the ones that I've talked to have had similar instances where, you know, rappel has gotten out of control. I mean, rappelling is dangerous. I mean, we can say, you know, people do it recreationally, you know, and they do, but it is dangerous. A lot of rock climbers I've talked to have had some near misses, very similar things, you know, and some didn't miss it and they hit the ground because of it. So once you get speed going, it's very hard to slow that down. So, I mean, it's, you know, everything's heating up, you know, your hands are heating up, the device is heating up, you're burning through the auto block. It just becomes really an unrecoverable situation at that point.
You don't remember too much about the actual fall itself other than gaining speed and can't slow down.
Yeah, and looking at the trees.
And looking at the trees.
I remember seeing the trees and thinking, I hope I hit the trees.
So at that point, John, you're on the ground. and we look kind of, we're looking at each other thinking something's just not 100% right. And so Mike, take us from there, because you were the first person over to get to John. What were you thinking setting up on top of the cliff, listening, hearing, and feeling all this?
Right. So there's a little bit of a scene that we have to portray on top of the cliff talking about John. So it's a small trail. We have many team members there now. Everybody has come from the first rescue, and we are stationing up above where the actual rappel setup is because it's a little bit safer. There's no cliff line. And we have our forestry law enforcement officers, both of them there with us at this point, because there's also somebody drunk on the trail raising a ruckus and trying to get down where we are and just kind of being a bit of a bastion for the LEOs. So they're in the midst of arresting this gentleman while John is rappelling over the edge. So we're actually trying to help just put a barrier up so this guy can't get down when I'm talking to you and a few others, Tracy. Do you remember this setup? Do you remember how these guys were kind of the one guy was trying to push down? Okay, so yeah. I then turned back around to talk to you, and that's when Mark yells out, "Oh shit," because he was feeling the rope all the way down. And you can feel the vibrations as somebody's rappelling, and then faster vibrations, and then a hit and no more vibrations. And Mark thinks he heard John hit. So he looks at me and says, "I think he just hit the ground." I said, "What do you mean?" And this is when our conversation started going. "Do you mean hit the ground? Like, oh, he kind of hit hard, or did he hit?" He's like, I heard him hit. Get ready to go down." So I get everything on. I didn't have my class three on, my harness on, because I wasn't going to be going over the edge. So I threw it on. I got all my med gear on me, and I go over to try and hook into the rope to rappel off. And John is still hard in the line because he's still on there. His auto block must have had a little bit of a catch to it because we can't pull it out of his device now. And in between all this, we start to set up another system to get down to him as we're trying to communicate with him on the radio, which has failed. Minutes have gone by since we've talked to him and we're setting up our new system. We finally get him to respond and free his device enough to where we can get enough slack in that rope so I can get on the system to rappel down the same rope. I knew what John used. I knew he had an issue. I chose a different rappel device. This was our figure eight. It was actually a rescue eight that I put into the dynamic rope, just because it gives you a little more control. Heavier, bigger, clunkier, but it gives you a little more control, and I can lock it off if I need to and go hands-free. Easier than some other devices. So I get on, I start going down, and I'm 10 feet, 15 feet over the edge, and things go through my mind then, like, why did John fall? So I start slowing down, and I actually stopped for a second, and I was trying to figure out, did the rope fail? Did the rope become unsheathed where the sheath of the core, the mantle, just followed him all the way down, and now what am I going to get onto? So I pull up about 5 feet of rope, and I still feel the weight, and John's on it, so I know it's not fractured completely. And I just decide to go down slow, and then I get a little more brave, and I pick up a little bit of speed, and I finally make it down without any issues. But just standing at the top of the cliff, that didn't go through my mind until I got onto the potentially bad rope. So
I'm going to tell you, that was a ballsy move. I mean, my hands are pretty sweaty here going through all this. I'll just be honest with you. But the fact that you did that, you know, and maybe you didn't think about the risk, but your intent at that point was to get down there and provide some help. So that's pretty ballsy.
Yeah. So as I was making it down to the bottom, I could see a little bit of John. So I saw him down there. I started talking to him. I didn't know if he could hear me or not, because our communication wasn't very, very good on the radio. So I didn't know if he was passed out or anything. So I just start talking to him, and I start giving him little mental jabs of, hey man, what the hell were you doing? You're supposed to stop, you know, just jabbing on him to see if he'll respond, not to push him, but just to see where his mentation is. Can't remember his exact words, but I think he said, I hit a little hard. And I said, well, at least you're still on the rope and you didn't fall the rest of the way, because down on the bottom of the cliff, it doesn't just go flat. There's some hillside that has rocks on it, old trees that have fallen off the cliff or just fallen over. And I'm not even exaggerating. 8 inches away from where he hit was nothing but rock. Where he hit was this 6-foot section of just nice, fluffy mattress leaves that had been degrading over the years. And he fell on his backpack. His backpack had water in it, some tuna that I just learned about tonight. I didn't know that busted in there. And I think the water bottles, his backpack, and just his size is what prevented him from having any serious injury. And he fractured his helmet. So he had a pretty good head hit as well.
Pretty good hit.
Yeah, we had to retire that helmet. I think he's going to put it up in the safe.
Here. Sitting here on the desk.
Yeah. So I get down to him, and I'm also a woofer, and you know, I start my assessment, and I got him talking to me now. So he's awake enough. He just didn't have the ability to hit his radio very good, because I think he was just a little stunned. I don't know if he passed out, but he was stunned. Consciousness was fine when I got down to him. As I start working him over, looking him over, I don't really see anything wrong with him, but we're just sitting there waiting for the team to finish the rescue raise up at the top. And I said, oh, hey, John, I totally forgot. I just need to check over your stomach. I'm just going to pull your pack off. And I pulled his pack off, and I pulled his jacket off, and I push on his stomach, and he's got some really serious tenderness that, to me, I was a little bit alarmed, but to him, he knows the system. He knows what I'm doing. He's like, what does that mean? What's wrong with me now? It's like, oh, you know, nothing. You're still awake. So I know you're not, you know, you're not too bad yet, but we're just going to keep an eye on it. And so all this starts going through his mind. He's like, what, do we need to do something now? I was like, no, we don't need, let's just get you up. Let's do one thing at a time. Let's get things rolling. He's got all this going through his head, and the backpack I finally pull off of him. And I think that was possibly what helped him and what hurt him, because he ended up having some fractures in that area of his back, from maybe from where it hit on the pack, or just maybe from the severe flexion and impact period. So we can't move him because he's got a back injury. He's got a helmet that's busted, so he's got a potential C-spine injury. And I just tie him off to the rock so he can't slide down anymore. He's already kind of falling into the magnolia. Billy, our other teammate, comes down with the basket, and he's a big fireman kind of guy. I don't know. He's pushing John's size as far as muscularity, but not his height. And him and I just, we cannot get this bear into the basket for anything that's we're worth. We have to brainstorm. So we rig up a system on the rope, and we just rig a quick 3-to-1 with some extra gear that we had. We hook it to John's harness and the bottom section and top section. We have 2 tie-in points, and we raise him up from below, just raise him up, slide the basket underneath him, get him in there. We tie him into the system that we have. We hook him up, and we're ready to go. I bet 2 minutes after that, we start raising him up, up the cliff, the 200-foot cliff. And the time you lose from when I rappel, and I say lose because it took 30 minutes, John. That's kind of a low estimate, I think. But in my head, it was 10 seconds because of just what you say. It's cloudy. It's not cloudy. It just everything happening at that time is weighing on you. Did I do what I need to do right? Did I forget to do something else? Did I leave something up top that I need? What happens if we waste 1 minute down here and we need to get you in the ambulance, and that's 1 minute that we wasted that we could have? So all these things go through your mind, just hoping that you did everything right this time. And not just because it's your teammate, but anytime that happens to somebody, you fall back on your training, and thank goodness that we train all the time, because it all fell into line the way it was supposed to. at least I feel it did.
Tell you what Mike touched on there. I wish I'd been alert enough to have seen all that going on, but where he did that 3-1 or 2-1 to get me in the basket, that's pretty darn clever. I mean, most people probably wouldn't think to do something like that. So he had the equipment with him and the knowledge to do it. Otherwise, you know, you needed more people down there to lift me up and get me in that basket. So he was able to do it with a couple of people using the equipment he had on his side. So saved a lot of time and a lot of manpower because we really didn't have the manpower to spare. I mean, as we talked about earlier, you know, we had 8 or 9 people out there and, you know, that's getting pretty, you know, bare bones when it comes to running a technical rope operation, unless you're well trained. You know, 2 of those 8 or 9 are on the base of the cliff at this point. So,
yeah. And then 3 on top were brand new.
First time,
that was their first time out.
To
be involved with that kind of stuff. So, but yeah, we were up on top rigging while Mike was taking care of John underneath. 30 minutes. If you'd asked me, I'd have said it was 4 hours. It just seems like took forever to get that system up, cutting the mountain laurel down and some getting a good path and anchoring and testing. In a situation like that, you can't shortcut. You got to go through all your tests and retest and verification and everything, safety checks. And so we get the system set up. Billy brings the basket over. You get John, as you refer to, the bear, into the basket. What happens then?
So our team at the top, the top side, we're bottom side, they're top side. Easy reference for us. So top side team starts the haul with our mechanical advantage. It's usually a 3-1, like a block and tackle system. And it isn't just hooking a winch up and just raising them up. It's a heave ho in a simple terms, it's a heave ho. So you get about a 10 foot distance up and then they have to reset their mechanical advantage system to regain another 10 feet or so. Free air. I remember specifically the rappel down. I'll step back to that. The brainstorm that I was going through about the rope and what could have happened to it. In the background are all the fireworks for the 4th of July. So as I'm rappelling off, I'm listening to the booms of the fireworks and looking at them. And the moon is right in the view and it's still dusk. It's like 9 at night, roughly. In that time of year, it was just dusk. So going up, it's now pitch black. And you can turn around and your spotlight is just what you think it is. I mean, you only see what your spotlight can reach. And I can see the cliff in front of me, John, the basket, Billy below me, and the trees that John went through. And it was limbs. I wouldn't call them anything heavy. And I doubt it was enough to break his fall, but maybe it did. Maybe it was just enough to get him pushed over to the side or spin him around to where he didn't hit on the rock, you know, so who knows what, whatever it was just enough. So I'm looking at my spotlight and I look up and I can't see anything because I can see the rope and then the shine of the rock in front of me. But then everything else up top is black until you can see the top side team and their headlights just shining different ways. And then our cliffside teammates that help us get over the edge looking down. And it's just kind of surreal because it really is a beautiful area in horrible circumstances, but a beautiful area. So it kind of will help put you at ease a little bit, just stepping back and realizing where you are, what you're doing, and now it's time to go to work. So you go to work, you get to the top of the cliff, and the transition is not like at a building where you have a nice sharp 90-degree angle and you just lift them up and push them over. You have a 250-pound sack of potatoes that is in a system where you're having to lift him up and out of the way at you, almost a deadlift up to your chest. And I'm 5'7" on a nice tall day, low gravity day, and pulling him up and turning him sideways to get him through the trees was like nothing. I don't know why, I don't know what happened that night, but it was just one good move. The team had it just perfect, set him sideways, pulled him in and got him to the top side, disconnected him from the system, left him in the basket and put him on our unicycle wheel for that basket, which is how we transport people out of the trail and keeping them in the basket and immobile. So that kind of concludes our raise. And now the walk out to the parking lot, required me doing another little assessment just to see if anything changed on the way up, because it really is hard to do any kind of that, anything like that, with limited resources on the rope.
So, John, do you remember anything about the raise?
No, I do remember hearing some fireworks when I was at the bottom. I'm assuming that's what it was. I do have, you know, I think Skybridge Station, a place we hang out at, I think they were shooting some fireworks, which wasn't too far away the way the bird flies. But no, the raise itself and getting to the top, I really don't recall any of that. About the only thing that really stuck in my mind, you know, was when my wife and my daughter, you know, showed up. And,
do you remember your wife showing up?
I remember
on the trail.
I don't remember on the trail. I remember them out at the, when I was getting ready to get on the ambulance.
I remember her. Once we got you up to the off the cliff edge up to the top of the ridgeline, she was there.
Yeah.
And she walked over to you and you raised your hand, which was burnt, you know, and the first words out of your mouth was, "I'm sorry."
Mm.
Do you remember that?
Mm-mm.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. And kind of get you.
Oh,
yeah.
I know it.
I mean, Mark has said several times that probably the hardest thing that he's ever seen was when Kathy and Madison, that's my wife and daughter, came walking down that trail that night. You know, he said it was like, you know, a shadow. He knew who it was, and he didn't know at that point if he was going to have to explain to them that I died out there that night. So he didn't really know, you know, how bad I was hurt, you know, what was going on. And they were actually, we'd been hosting a 4th of July get together at my house before. Well, actually, I left before anybody got there that day. So my wife was entertaining, and they couldn't really reach her. I know they said they tried many times and ended up sending a deputy to the house to actually get her, which I'm sure that was a shock to have a police cruiser pull in your driveway when you know your husband's out doing a rescue. So,
yeah. But
yeah, you know, seeing them, before I get on the ambulance, I remember seeing both of them, and I remember feeling really bad because I'm like, did I get out here and really kill myself, or, you know, jack myself up the rest of my life? And, you know, I hate that I did that to you guys. I'm sure that's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
But it's a near-death experience like that, and that's what I call this. I mean, you know, my injuries, you know, although they still, you know, still have some issues with my back and probably always will, I'm doing really well. I was back doing rescue work, I guess, in a couple of months after that. My first order of business was to take the back brace I was in for 8 or 9 weeks, and we blew it up with an AR-15 and some Tannerite, and that felt unbelievably good.
That'd make a person feel good. Tell us your injuries.
Yeah, so I ended up with compression fractures of T2, 3, 4, 5, and so I got some herniated disc in there now that gave me a little bit of an issue. I had a pretty severe concussion. I didn't really realize that initially, but other people that were around me for several weeks they came, even just within the last few weeks, somebody was telling me, like, man, those first few weeks, you were pretty jacked up. I mean, I was at work. I was sending out duplicate emails. I went to work 2 days after the incident, and I believe in working. I don't milk the system, so I went back to work, and I probably shouldn't have. Finally, they told me, the doctor said, you got to go home and let your brain rest, because it's just, you know, I wasn't doing myself any favors. So I took a couple of days and then back at it. So the head injury, I'd never had a concussion that I knew about, but it was, you know, the doing duplicate emails, a little bit of being unstable, you know, standing on rocks. The strangest thing was, and I didn't really know what was happening, but, you know, I was working on a cabin during some of this, and I was driving back and forth to the construction side, and I would be sick as a dog when I would get home. And I'm like, what, you know, what is going on? I mean, it was car sickness is basically what it was. I couldn't figure it out. And I finally talked to my doctor. He said, yeah, that's from your concussion. You know, that's a symptom. And I'm like, I never heard of that before, you know, but all that has cleared. So really the only issues now would just be, you know, probably what I'll deal with the rest of my life, a little bit of back pain, but it's not debilitating in any form or fashion. So we enjoy getting back out there and doing rescues, not every weekend, but close to it. So we like
it. And it hasn't slowed you off the cliffs, then?
No, it hasn't.
The cliffs. And matter of fact, you went back out to that same spot. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it was, that was another pretty emotional moment for me. You know, I knew what I had to do. I'm like, I've got to get back out and get on rope, because if I don't, I may never do it again. And I knew in my heart I wanted to. Sometimes your heart and your mind don't always see things the same way. But, you know, once I got released, you know, that I was good to go, which I don't know, 2 or 3 months after the incident, I guess, my teammates went with me and we went straight back out to Chimney Rock and I went over the cliff again. So it wasn't the same side. It was the opposite side, because we wanted to do some training on the other side of that cliff, which is actually where the lady was located at that we were going to get that night. We wanted to see if it was, you know, a good area to set up a rappel or a raise lower. And I tell you, it was, you know, stepping on the edge of that cliff, you know, I'm like, wow, okay, this is going to happen. And, you know, I just, you know, you just kind of go through it. And once I started over, I was fine. You know, it didn't, you know, you just have to get your mind around things and don't let your mind control you. I knew I was perfectly safe. I, you know, I had got the best team in the world up there controlling the systems and it was good to go. And I, you know, to this day, I appreciate them coming out there and, first of all, for rescuing me, you know, big dodo that got himself hurt during the rescue. You never want that to happen. You know, that's bound to make the news when that happens. So you don't want to see it. But said many times, I couldn't have been more proud of the team that I'm part of, that I've been part of for a long time. Probably one of the most stressful situations they could be placed under, you know, with their chief, you know, at the bottom of a cliff, you know, not really knowing how bad he's hurt. And those guys being able to come together and pull off a rescue and then coming back out to support me when I wanted to do it again. So it's just a great bunch of people. Tracy, you're part of it. Craig's been around us. I mean, it's the folks on this team. I mean, I just can't say enough about them. You know, they're all just top notch in my book.
One of the things that I remember from being up on topside was how calm topside was. And that's a reflection upon Mark Ryan, who was running the system up there and getting everything set up. Everyone remained extremely calm, but focused, obviously. Mm-hmm. And it just worked out so well about getting you back up. But the amount of professionalism that everybody displayed and the calmness and that they showed that night was, that sticks into my head. Mm-hmm. Another thing that sticks into my head, and actually Craig brought this up, was after all this was said and done, several of you guys, the upper management of the team, you all did an after action review and you all dug into the gear and setup and what happened. I know, Mike, you were part of this, obviously, but you all tried to figure out what happened. Yeah. And you wanted to share that with what's the organization that you all send the information to?
American Alpine Club. Accidents in North America, American Alpine Club.
Yeah. And tell us about that, Mike. They what, document and log accidents and get that information out across the United States for other people to learn, right?
They document, I believe it's actually Accidents and Mountaineering in North America, but they document almost anything that happens rescue related, rope related, climbing, mountaineering, to try and educate people, and so that we can also see where most of the accidents happen. And believe it or not, a lot of accidents happen during rappelling. Mm-hmm. And small things that lead to the big, multiple small things that lead to the big that we referenced earlier, but it's absolutely true. John rappels. John's not a climber. He doesn't rappel every weekend. I rappel. Not this year because of COVID, but I rappel almost every weekend climbing. I've mountaineered, rappelled. I have climbing gym rappel, you know, so it's something that I do all the time. And I have my gear. Everybody has their own gear that they use. John had his one piece that was backwards, you know, one small mistake there, compounded by John not rappelling at that particular place. And now it's at night. So now we got 4 small things. And those 4 small things added to the dynamic rope, now 5 things. Now that dynamic rope got even smaller, so that's maybe a little bit more. So we had multiple things that led, that we think led to the uncontrolled descent. During the uncontrolled descent, he had the auto block on, and we normally will, You control the amount of grip that the auto block has with your hand. when he, what we believe is when he found that he was unable to control his descent, instead of pushing down on the rope by itself and letting the auto block climb to the actual device, meaning grip harder, he pulled the auto block down with him. And that is where the final and most detrimental mistake happened, according to what our theory is. There's no video of it. That's just based on burn patterns on his fingers, on his hands, his gloves, and on the auto block itself.
We made the decision fairly early on, I guess within a day or two, that my intent was to not sweep this under the rug. It's not something that you're, you know, I've been doing this a long time and never had an accident. And it, I'll be honest, it's a little embarrassing that it happened. You know, I consider myself a professional. I consider myself to be very, you know, safety minded. I mean, everything we do, we try to make sure it's done right. And the fact that it happened, you know, I'm like, this can happen to me. It can happen to anyone. And if we can take my accident and, you know, help someone else to prevent that from happening to them, we'll deal with it. You know, and we, you know, we took some shots. I mean, you know, there are people you don't know, you know, they, as we all know on social media, people like to jump on and, you know, throw their jabs and you throw one right back. I mean, look, we're being upfront and honest about what happened. It was some mistakes, some minor mistakes, ended up in a, you know, what could have been a very, very bad situation. I mean, it was bad enough, but it could have been even worse. So I'm still glad we did it.
Craig was one. Craig, you can jump in if you want to, but it would have been easy to somewhat sweep that underneath the rug, or at least state level. Anyway, of course, it'd be reported to KYM, but I think that's just a show of character to sit back, analyze it, figure out what's going on, and then for the betterment of everyone, try to get that information out to other people so that they won't fall victim to the same small errors that lead up to a big error. But Craig, you're the one who brought that up to me talking about it.
Yeah, I think it's, in short, I think it's noble that you brought it up in such a public manner the way you did. And I think it's just, and you mentioned it earlier too, John, I think Mike did as well. It's just professionalism at its best. You can't have something like this happen and not share it. That's right. What professionals do. I mean, it's just what right. You do because you're in the service of others. So by sharing it, you do help others. In just one more way than you already do. I mean, it's just, and again, I think it's noble. That's why I wanted to get on. I wanted more details I just can't thank you enough that you've shared the information the way you have.
Yeah. Well, we're happy to do it. I mean, you know, once again, it's, you never want to do something that ends up in injury or embarrassment, but you know, things happen to people, you know, with a lot more experience than what we have even, you know, and it's just, I think it's important to share it. I know it's had an impact because we've had at least one of the squad, you know, well, multiple squads, but one in particular out of North Carolina contacted us and, you know, wanted to know exactly what had happened. They were using some similar systems and they moved away from it, you know, because of that. So that alone made it worth it, you know, in my mind. So, and we learned from it. So I think we're a better team because of it as well. So you take the knocks sure. And you put improvements in place and you move on. And hopefully it never happens again. And that's sure. Our goal. Safety is always our top priority above anything else. You know, Mike's typically our safety officer. Anytime we're out there, I point Mike if he's not involved, you know, up to his eyeballs in a medical mess. He will be our safety person because he's very focused on that. And he's very situational aware, I would say. I mean, he sees things that I may not always see. You know, so it's, I know Tracy talked about feeling better about him being out there as a medic. I feel better when he's out there as a safety officer. So, yep, very much so. He fills many roles. And we can't forget about Mark. Listen, I told Mark I was going to mention it. I'm going to do it. You can edit it out if you want. But Mark and Billy completed that rescue that night after all the mayhem that had occurred. Those guys sucked it up and went around and got that lady and got her out of there. So, you know, a happy ending. That ended up being three rescues for the night for those gentlemen. So they did an outstanding job.
Yeah, they did complete the went over the side of the cliff and yeah. Found the lady and walked her out to the road, I believe, if I remember right. So kudos to them. Kudos to the team and good job there. Craig, got any questions?
I'm good, man. Everybody. This has been fabulous. Thank you all for letting me be part and listen in on how this went down.
Yeah. John, anything fantastic. Else you want to add?
No, I think we pretty well covered it. Yeah. You know, appreciate you guys having us on here. We love talking search and rescue, and you know, hopefully your listeners will find it interesting, and you know, we can do some more later on down the road. We'd be happy to do that as well. So we love talking to you guys.
Yeah, absolutely.
Craig and I set out to set out a lost and found episode based upon what went right, what went wrong, and how they could improve. Again, trying to put out information to other hikers and campers so that the same mistakes aren't being made. And you were on at least one of those. Mm-hmm. And so this winter we'll try to get you back out and talk about some of those one or two of the 700 rescues that you've been on. And maybe we can even talk about the cow that you all rescued.
Oh, we've got some good video if you're walking the cow.
Mike, we appreciate you jumping on. Anything else you want to add to all this? We greatly appreciate your expertise.
No, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on. It is a little bit weird talking about it in a forum that, not just openly, but in a forum where we can't be face to face. So I look forward to being able to do that again in the future.
Yeah,
COVID's, thank you, Mike.
COVID's got everything kind of messed up right now, but hopefully we'll get back to somewhat normal down the road a little bit. Absolutely. Well, guys, I appreciate it. And I know the listeners are going to enjoy this. We'll go ahead and close out down the road, maybe have you guys back and talk about another topic. So we appreciate
it. Thanks for the invite. Have a good night, guys.
Yep. See you.
And that wraps up another fantastic episode of the Nature Blinds podcast. I hope today's journey has inspired you to explore and connect with the natural world in new and exciting ways. Before I say goodbye, remember to check out the Nature Blinds School online membership. If today's episode sparked your interest in wilderness skills and outdoor adventures, this online community is the perfect place for you to start or continue your journey. You can currently sign up for a year for only $99 and get 2 months for free. Click the link below to discover a world of expert-led courses, engaging content, and a vibrant community eager to share their knowledge and experiences. Whether you're starting your outdoor journey or looking to deepen your existing skills, the Nature Reliant School online membership is here to guide you. Thank you for joining us today. Don't forget to subscribe for more adventures and share this podcast with your fellow nature enthusiasts. Until next time, come on, join in. Let's learn together.